Welcome, y'all, to the Direct Examination Podcast. I'm Amber Fulmer.
I'm Dane Phillips.
And I'm Joseph Bias. Amber, you're back. Welcome.
Yay! Back to the land of the living.
I know. It feels like it's been forever. How are you?
Good. Good. Was I done with all the 6 COVID tests the last time I was on? Or that was like right as we were cresting?
I don't know. Yeah. You were out being super mom and super lawyer, but it's good to have you back.
I remember a lot of January. Might have been from a lot of sinus pressure in my face.
Fair enough. And Dane, how are you, buddy?
Oh, I'm living the dream. So I got the baby in one arm and then the not-so-baby 4-year-old who's gotten shy all of a sudden, who's definitely not shy in the other, joining us with the podcast. We got some co-hosts decided not to do the opening of the podcast. We'll have to talk about that because she definitely wants to be apparently a YouTube star.
Good money in that. You should get behind it right now.
Her and her grandmother have been making some cupcakes, and they'll send me a video of her doing basically just like the YouTube people. So you live the dream over here at the Phillips household.
So get on that. That baby baker's already all over Facebook.
Look for the spinoff podcast in the fall. In the kitchen with the Phillips kids. Well, obviously, if you're listening to this, thank you so much for listening to this podcast before you eventually subscribe to Dane's Kids podcast. If you're listening, like, share, subscribe. We really appreciate the feedback. We know we've gotten a lot of new listeners recently. We love that. So if you like this episode, if you like the show, go back and listen to some old ones. Follow Dane on social media. He's been tweeting out some of our and putting on Facebook some of our greatest hits, as they were, some of the better ones that we've done. Go back and listen to the good ones, the bad ones, and just enjoy the show because we love doing it. We love bringing it to you. Right, guys?
Yep. We did.
Wonderful.
Look,
we brought our family to the pod.
Like, share, and subscribe. At the end of the day, the reason why I decided to start really posting some of the old stuff is because we have all these new listeners. I want to make sure if somebody comes across it, they know that, yes, we're putting out illustrious guest content now, but we've been doing
And that you originally started with this. A third
We've never left. You know?
That's right. And that Amber exists, that we didn't just make Amber
and
that
up. I exist. Yeah. And then I pregnant and then
Amber is definitely the cornerstone of the podcast.
Me and Dane are like, you know, my girlfriend that lives in Canada, she's totally real. It's like our co-host who lives she's actually real, we promise. One more thing before we get to our illustrious guests, and as Dane knows, we have nothing but illustrious guests. You know, recently in the news in South Carolina, there's been a lot of new podcasts that I'm not saying that are on our block, but there are folks who are kind of trying to nuzzle their way in. It's fine. We don't feel threatened or anything like that, guys, do we?
So, look, this was on my notes to bring up tonight. So, we got...
So, we're both in the same...
You know, look, we got Asylum, which are friends of the pod.
Yeah, shout out to Rhodes.
And it's on our list. I'm sure we'll have them on to talk about their podcast. There's that Bourbon in the Back Room.
Vincent Shaheen.
Right, and Joel Lurie. And so
haven't been on yet, but they're welcome. Shout out to Vincent and
That would be great.
Wonderful.
Right, so, you know, they're on my radar. So we got, I mean, I'm with Joe you. Cunningham. I'm not saying we lit the fire.
But, look, Joe Cunningham.
But we did.
Look.
That's, I mean.
I'm saying is this, guys, you know. Before there could be a LeBron James, there had to have been a Michael Jordan, right? Okay. We set the foundation for all of these other shows, and they're all great, I'm sure. Go listen to them. Go subscribe to them. But come back and listen to us because we're
just compared me to Michael Jordan, and I think I might cry.
First thing, shout out to the GOAT. It's his birthday today.
Joseph was saying is if you want to listen to the OG podcast, you know where to
listen
find.
To us.
Those are great podcasts, but...
Like how we're just not even going to get to a guest. We're just going to talk up ourselves all day. Just like True
Lies. What happens when COVID takes you away from people and you finally get adults and you get to be social?
Yeah. If you host another podcast, hit us up. We'll do a home and home. We'll have you on. We'll be on y'all's. And we're excited for South Carolinians and for Columbians and Charlestonians and all those other folks to get more information, more entertainment out there. But guys, we can't waste any more time because we have an illustrious guest today. We have somebody who I'm very excited to talk to. Amber, why don't you tell us about her?
Our guest today is Donna White. She is the Associate Director of the South Carolina for Criminal Justice Reform. So the SC4CJR. And she also is the owner of Donna White Counseling and Consulting. She is a licensed professional counselor, as well as a licensed addictions counselor with over 17 years experience treating mental health and substance abuse disorders. She has a wide range of experience, including working in detention centers and with at-risk youth. South Carolina for Criminal Justice Reform is a grassroots, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to the holistic criminal justice reform in South Carolina via research, education, collaboration, and advocacy. And without further ado,
Donna, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
That built me up reading that. That's awesome.
Don, let's start with, so we're going to call this episode Mental Health, a Mental Illness and Substance Abuse in the Criminal Justice System. And we're going to get to lawyers in a little bit, but let's start with the background information. So as far as statistics regarding mental illness, and substance abuse, for our listeners who are dealing with incarcerated individuals, individuals in jail, or folks who could end up there, do you have any information about that that would be helpful to our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the most part, we know that mental health and substance use and crime all go hand in hand, but the statistics are pretty interesting. So according to NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 people have a mental illness, and 1 in 25 people have a serious mental illness. Nearly 2 million people with mental illness are booked each year. So that's a pretty large number of people that get booked. And then according to SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, a little over 20 million people over the age of 18 have had a substance use disorder within the last year. And from NIDA's information, which is the National Institute on Drug Abuse, it's about 85% of prison population has an active substance use disorder or are incarcerated for a crime due to drugs or drug use.
When you said the 1 in 25 have a serious mental, what do they classify as serious versus the 1 in 5 has some sort of mental illness, and then that is the 1 in 25?
Yeah. So serious mental illness are things like schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, things like that.
So, I mean, as a criminal defense lawyer, you know, I always tell everybody that most of my cases deal with mental health and substance abuse. And a lot of times it's self-medication, the drug addiction or substance abuse is related to self-medicating, kind of either undiagnosed mental illness or diagnosed, but people don't have good access to treatment and counseling, et cetera, and medication. So with that, how did you get started and really kind of with getting into the criminal justice part? I mean, I believe you're on the board of director, your associate director. And so how really did you get kind of in this niche of the criminal justice system where it intersects with counseling and everything that goes with it?
Yeah. So in undergrad, I started taking a bunch of classes just as electives, and I ended up with a criminal justice minor, which was kind of cool. I didn't really know that was what my interest was, but it was. And so I had a very unique experience as an undergraduate where I got to actually intern at the detention center. And I knew I wanted to be a counselor. That's what I went to school for. I knew I was going to get my master's so I could pursue that. But my experience at the detention center during undergrad is really what kind of sparked that interest, because I got to see firsthand how mental illness and substance use intersected with the criminal justice stuff. And what I found to be very interesting was just the way mental health issues were perceived, the way substance issues were perceived, and how they played a part in people's recovery and, you know, their length of time being incarcerated, what their lives were like getting out and coming back in. And I had a very unique experience of meeting a guy who had served I think it was about 18 years on a murder charge, and he had been released, and I met him because he got arrested 6 months later. And I got to spend a lot of time talking to him. And one of the things that he shared was that, you know, after all of that time being incarcerated, he really had no clue how to function in society. Mm-hmm. He had some mental health issues that had not been addressed, but he couldn't really get the help that he needed because he had had all these charges. And it blocked his access to care on some levels. You know, he had some substance use issues in the past, and he was trying not to go back there, but it was really hard because he didn't really have a lot. And so it was just interesting. He actually committed a small crime just so he could go back to jail. And I thought that was really fascinating and sad. You know, it was just that that was his only way of survival. And so it really just kind of got me interested in that piece in terms of how those things connect.
I wonder what the overall impact is of, you know, what the recidivism rate just associated with untreated mental health, substance abuse issues while incarcerated with these other things, just that.
Yeah.
In and of itself, because I've had a client before that has told me, pointed from, I think, yes, for one of the South Carolina sexually violent predator acts, about how the lack of the materials and things that they had there, just even just in other courses or things like that. So that those needs were being addressed.
So Donna, as officers of the court, you know, most of the people listening to this are attorneys or law students or judges, you know, there then, if I'm hearing you correctly, becomes a need for the attorneys to understand these disorders and to understand that the individual who is committing these crimes may not necessarily should be judged for it in the way that the court system usually judges him or her for that, right?
Absolutely. You know, you think about mental illness and substance use disorders, and it's not a choice. And I'll get to that in a little bit because I can get on it. I can do an entire series on why addiction is not a choice, but I'll touch on it briefly a little bit. But, you know, those things are not a choice, and understanding where they come from, that, you know, they're caused by genetic and environmental factors, change in brain chemistry, things like that, and that people are put at risk for mental illness and substance use disorders by different things. Again, it can be genetics, chronic medical conditions, stress and trauma, history of abuse and neglect. So you think about family history with substance use, you know, we talk about addiction being a family disease, having a mental health disorder, because interestingly enough, the use of alcohol and drugs can sometimes exacerbate or relieve mental health symptoms. So people will often use to self-medicate, free adolescents, peer pressure. So there's so many factors that go into how people end up with mental health disorders and substance use disorders. And it's just important to seek understanding and really look at how they got there and not be judgmental.
So, I mean, with addiction and kind of what goes into kind of spotting those identifiers, and there's so many intersections with addiction, substance abuse, and a treatment with the criminal justice system. You know, as a former public defender, I quickly acknowledged what you were just talking about, that many of my clients had some real significant trauma in their life, either through physical, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. And it wasn't unheard of for many of the individuals that suffered from severe addiction to have started doing, you know, for the audience. So we're on a Zoom call when we record these podcasts now.
Yeah, leave this part
pandemic, and my child is grabbing the microphone.
You're getting some help with the microphone.
Yeah, and
this
so,
is great. Like watching Netflix.
But
anyway,
but we're talking about. Go ahead.
So kind of where I was going with it is that with that, it quickly identified that it wasn't uncommon to have people that suffer from severe addiction to have started with drugs and alcohol at 9 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old, just very young ages. And a lot of it, I hate to say, was encouraged by their family. But certainly if it wasn't encouraged, it certainly was not an issue that that it wasn't was going
discouraged,
on.
Right?
Exactly. Right, it wasn't discouraged. Yeah. There wasn't an opinion as to
right. There was access to it, and right. certainly was not discouraged.
Yeah, there is actually some data that says for South Carolina, the age of first use, and so not sustained use, not continued use, but just experimental use, the average age is about 10, which is pretty startling. You think about middle school students. I think about my daughter, she's 9, and I'm like, do we need to have a conversation about drugs? Like, you right. don't think that, but yeah, so the age of first use is pretty early. And if you think about it in terms of what adolescents are dealing with and what they're going through, it's not uncommon for them to pick up any, you know, a substance to cope with that. And so a lot of times it starts with nicotine or alcohol or other, you know, what we call little small substances people like to refer to, but I mean, a substance
marijuana.
Is a substance.
I mean, that's
yeah,
that's
marijuana, you know?
Yep.
And so the thing that's interesting about addiction is that you don't know if you have that precursor to be addicted to a substance. So it's why, like, mm-hmm. I might be able to use something and put it down and never have a problem. And then you use it and you can't stop. And the only way you really know is if you start to use. So that makes it a little, you know, it makes it a little tricky. So again, when people go back to talking about addiction being a choice, if you knew the first time you would pick up a drug, you were going to be addicted to it and it was going to wreck your entire life, most people would not choose to do that. You wouldn't wake up and go, I think I'm going to try a little cocaine and it's going to just take me down, you know? Right. You're like, I'm just going to do this. Most people wouldn't make that choice. Now, you do make the choice to pick it up, but you don't make the choice to become addicted.
So you talked about, you know, addiction being such a big factor. And, you know, I think it should be noted, we're not just talking about alcohol and drug addiction. There's obviously very different types of addictions that mm-hmm. could impact the criminal justice system. You know, how should, if we're operating under the banner of addiction isn't a choice, how should we as attorneys get better at recognizing mental health issues, get better at recognizing addiction so that we can do the best possible job for our clients?
I think the first thing is asking questions. So when you notice something is different or you notice something is off or you know you have a client with a history, ask the questions and do it in a way that's not going to add more stigma. So if you know, some of the symptoms that you can recognize is that if you notice that a person is like sad or withdrawn for more than 2 weeks, if they are seeing and hearing things that nobody else can see or hear, you know, if they're talking about suicide or they have a plan for suicide or they have attempted suicide, having sudden overwhelming fears, rapid weight gain loss, any really excessive, you know, like excessive AOD use, which is, you know, alcohol and drug use, and drastic changes in mood, sleep, and behaviors, those types of things. If you see those, ask the questions. Hey, what's going on? Tell me, I've noticed that, you know, when I try to reach you, you're sleeping, like you're sleeping all day. Like, what's going on? So asking those questions, you know, substance use is a little tricky because the way it presents is depending on what you're using. So if you're using a stimulant, you know, you might see a person mm-hmm. that's really hyperactive. They're not sleeping a lot. They might have rapid speech, you know, rapid thought patterns. But if somebody's using something like an opiate or something, you know, a benzo, like Xanax, Clonopin, things like that, you're going to see more of a depressed, that slurred speech, kind of the drowsiness kind of thing. But if you notice those things, ask the questions and ask in a way that makes them want to seek help and makes them want to disclose more.
The one thing I really wanted, you know, kind of looking at our outline, the addiction as a brain disease, could you really go into that in depth? I know that that's, you know, there's plenty of people that probably would disagree. And since it's a controversial topic, I'd love for us to address it. I mean, we got the expert here on the pod. And so, you know, some people believe it's all choice and other people, you certainly there's data and research to suggest otherwise.
Yeah.
And so I'd love for you to kind of expound upon that as well. Cause in addition to identifying it, another is to try to provide explanation, especially again, though the legal aspect of it in criminal cases, we, you know, defense lawyers have to present what's called mitigation evidence. And that's to try to explain to the judge, not as an excuse, but as an explanation for why things happened, why there was a drug addiction that caused this person to either commit a crime or to get arrested and be charged with possession of drugs. And so if you could, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I'm going to nerd out a little bit on this one because I get really excited about talking about addiction as a brain disease. So I tell people all the time, like when you pick up a substance, that's a choice. If I pick up a beer and decide to taste it, I have made a choice to taste it. But what's interesting about addiction as a brain disease is that addictive drugs provide like a shortcut to the brain's reward system by flooding it with dopamine. So that feel good hormone that you get when you exercise or you eat like your favorite food, your brain drugs provide that same feeling and they flood that reward system, right? So with repeated use of that substance, it hijacks pretty much the limbic system. So it changes the brain, it weakens the system, and it causes it to believe that that substance is the primary need for survival. And if you think about that, that makes a lot of sense, because what we see with people with continued and sustained substance use is that they will neglect primary needs like food and relationships and water and shelter and things like that. So it tricks the brain into believing like this substance is the only thing I need for survival. So the prefrontal cortex, which is why I said I'm going to nerd out a little bit, right? The prefrontal cortex, it sits at the front of your, like front of your brain. Put your hand on your forehead. That's like where your prefrontal cortex is. And that is the part of your brain that's responsible for decision-making and reasoning. Now, the hippocampus is another part of the brain that kind of lays down those memories of, so when you think about using substances, if you use a substance, it feels great. The hippocampus kind of stores this memory and it's like, yeah, that felt great. So the amygdala, which is a tiny little almond-shaped piece of the brain, creates a conditioned response to that. The amygdala is interesting because it can override the prefrontal cortex. So when a person continues to use substances, the hippocampus, you know, holds that memory of, oh, this is great. And the amygdala goes, yeah, let's go for it, because that is a great feeling.
So you forget the bad stuff.
Yes. And so it also takes away the ability to make good decisions and reason. So in a person who does not have an addiction, let's say I take a drink, I don't have an addiction, I drink a little too much. And so the next time I get ready to drink, I have that memory. But then the prefrontal cortex, that part of the decision and the reasoning, all that stuff in my brain goes, you know what, you should probably stop drinking now, because the last time you drank that much, you got on the table and you danced. Probably don't want to do that again, right? So it works.
So you've known Dane for a while, in other words.
This is what happens. Anyway.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Like,
but when a person with a substance use disorder does that, the amygdala goes, no, let's just go for it because it feels good. So that ability to make decisions and reason and think ahead, you know, all those things that, you know, what's going to happen or why should, you know, should I not do this? Should I do this? And being able to reason that out doesn't happen. And so it's the reason, you know, you think about, you hear these stories, and I used to work in an inpatient treatment facility, and I have literally had women hand me their children and walk out because they're fighting this urge to use. And when you think about that not being a choice, they're not willingly saying, here, take my kid because I don't want them. The substance has become the primary need for survival. So it has wiped away the need for everything else. And they go with that feeling. And I think the reason I'm so passionate about talking about addiction as a brain disease is because when people understand that it changes the way that the brain functions, then you can have a little more empathy and compassion for people. The way that we talk to them, the way that we treat them, all of that changes because the way we understand it is different. Mm-hmm. And that is why that's so important. And you know, so I tell people when I talk about this, like my goal is not to convert you to a believer of addiction as a brain disease, but consider it as an option. Look at the science. You know, what I just described is a very brief snippet of the explanation of that. You know, you can go way deep into all different parts of the brain and talk about all of those structures you know, in more detail, but there's science that supports that. And when we understand that, we can treat people a little differently because we understand that they're not just making a choice. We don't put that expectation of, well, you should just stop using. You should be a better mom. You should be a better son. You should be, you know, should be a better parent, whatever. We don't hold those things as high, like, over their heads because we understand that they're struggling with something that they really can't control. Now, the great thing about the brain is that it's very resilient. And so with treatment and, you know, certain types of therapy, you can change the brain. You know, it will bounce back. It's pretty resilient, but that's over time. And with, abstinence from substances. So
I think that's important stuff to know. And, you know, like you said, we can kind of go on talking about the implications of addiction and mental illness, but I wanted to take some time to talk about attorneys and judges and how that impacts what we do. And, you know, we've had more than a couple episodes, gosh, maybe three or four, about mental health of attorneys and how we can recognize it. Just based on your experience, what are some things that lawyers, that you see in attorneys and judges regarding mental health and substance abuse that may be of interest to our listeners? And what are some things that lawyers can do as far as self-care to help them out, help ourselves out?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've actually worked with a few attorneys, and, you know, what I've noticed is that you guys have very high caseloads, often work very long hours. The job is stressful. You know, you're in a helping profession, much like, you know, counselors and other people. It's just a little bit different, but it's still a helping profession. Like, you dedicate your time and energy to serving people. And so when you do that, there is important to find the balance between what you're giving out and what you're taking in. We take a lot in and we give a lot out, and we're not always aware of that exchange and making sure that there's a balance between the two. So my advice to people is always just to kind of think about what you do as a checkbook. That's what I like to tell people, like a bank account. So you want to make sure that, you know, you're not, people are withdrawing. Like, that's what happens in our jobs. And, you know, as attorneys and legal professionals and judges, people are constantly withdrawing. Colleagues, the people that we're working with. But who's making deposits? What are you making a deposit of? How are you depositing in yourself? So just being able to kind of take a break. One thing that I noticed, though, with legal professionals is that they're often really hesitant about seeking help because of the fear of judgment and stigma. Like, people are going to think I can't do my job if I say I'm depressed, or, you know, who wants to have an attorney with anxiety issues? You know what I mean? So it's very hard sometimes for them to seek that therapy or the treatment that they need out. And I like to remind them that you can do that. And it's a counselor's job to keep that information confidential. So, you know, don't be afraid to reach out. Don't be afraid to look for what you need. Talk to people, talk to your colleagues, talk to mental health professionals, but be aware of self-care. Taking time for yourself is not selfish. It is necessary. And we don't do enough of it. We just don't.
Well, I assume that attorneys, based on at least the statistics that we've discussed in prior episodes and had people on to talk about, that we're a high risk.
Absolutely.
I mean, we have addictive personalities. We have kind of over the top type, larger than life type personalities, egos, everything in between.
High need to achieve.
Exactly.
Be the best.
And that I've heard one attorney who regularly speaks on this issue, him saying that, you know, his whole life was that need to achieve. And through that, once he became an attorney, there really was nothing else for him to achieve after he had accomplished most of his goals as an attorney. You know, he'd made money, he had gotten the awards and that really was kind of that his whole life had been, you know, what's the next thing to accomplish? What's the next thing to accomplish? Right. And he kind of hit that wall of, well, there's nothing else left. And that's where the substance abuse and depression really started to escalate, because he wasn't able to satisfy that need. And so, you know, one of the things, before I forget, that part of our bar dues, you know, our money pays for it, is I believe it's five free counseling sessions. So look, if you're a member of the bar, your bar dues have helped pay for
five. You prepaid for it.
Right. Yeah. So if it's already paid for, use it. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, use it before you need it. And I think, you know, that goes into part of self-care. We think about therapy as being something that we use when we need it. Like, oh, you know, well, I'm not there yet. I don't need it.
I consider it good grooming.
It is. It really is. You know? I'm like, I'm going to go see a therapist before I need one, because I know I'm getting ready to need one. Let me go check on some things now. So, you know, and you made an interesting point about, you know, being high achievers and how that kind of impacts things. But also, there's a culture sometimes within professions, like drinking after hours. You know, you have a big case and you go out and you drink, and, you know, and that can sometimes be a trigger or an issue for some people. Because I've heard people say, you know, like, I don't want to be the one person that goes out and doesn't drink, but also don't want to not go out, you know? So there's some things that come along with the culture of different professions that can play a part as well.
Well, Donna, you know, like I said, we can talk so much more about all this, and we're definitely going to have you back on to go in depth on some of these issues. If they want to have more information about the resources available for lawyers through the South Carolina Bar, you can go to the bar's website. Like Dane said, you can take advantage of those five free sessions. And Lawyers Helping Lawyers is also a great organization that we've had people on the pod talk about who, you know, take advantage of that. Are there any more resources that attorneys or anyone else can know about if they're needing help, or if they know somebody who can who needs some help? Is there any other resources that you can provide right now?
Yes. So SC for CJR, our organization, we have put together a resource list that is going to be on our website. So if you check out scforcjr.org, it is not live yet, but it will be within the next week or so. It's going to have a list of as many as we can gather, mental health treatment facilities, substance abuse treatment facilities, self-help groups like AA, NA, CA, all types of resources, all in one location. So a lot of times it's overwhelming to try to find where to go or what you need, but we're going to have everything there. We're going to have it by region. Perfect. If you click over to our website, it'll be there. And it's a good resource for attorneys and judges who are looking to help people get into treatment, but it can also be for themselves. So, you know, everything is going to be a one-stop shop. So we're super excited about being able to provide that as a resource. We'll have a PDF available as well, so people can print it out if they need to. But it's one of the things that we were super excited about being able to put together. And we're also going to have the ability for, if you don't see your facility or practice listed on the website, there's going to be a way to make sure that we get your information so we can add it. So it's going to be a continuing document. It's going to be ever evolving, but it's going to be a great place to start.
Well, we appreciate the work. And again, that website is SC4CJR. And if you want more information on that organization, we've done two previous episodes with Allie Minagakis, who talked about it. Allie's wonderful. She's going to be back on the show too, I'm sure. But SC4CJR, also at SC4CJR on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, but not TikTok. But we'll work on that. Dane, did I cut you off?
Look, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you so much for the outstanding work that your organization's doing, because, you know, you touched on a lot of the main issues of why treatment should be the goal versus incarceration. Mm-hmm. You know, that we need to solve the root problem. Mm-hmm. And so treatment can only do that, and incarceration does not. And as far as the recidivism rates, as Amber touched on. So just wanted to say thank you so much.
Donna, if people want to hear more about SC4CJR, they can, of course, go to a website, social media. They can follow you at Donna White, D-O-N-N-A White, L-P-C. You know, this is wonderful, great information. I think it's going to be really helpful to everybody, whether you're practicing criminal law or not. And we will tweet out from our account when that website is up, when that resource is up from SC4CJR. You can always follow us at SC Law Pod on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow me at Joseph P. Bias. You can follow Dane at SC Crim Lawyer. His kids, we don't have the Twitter account for them yet, but they will have it when their podcast set up. And then, of course, you can follow Amber, who we didn't make up, guys.
No, at here.
Red Judicata.
The red. I'd also say that for Dane, you need to send us the links to like the PayPals for the scholarships, right, and we can post that in the YouTube comments section.
Look, anybody wants to donate, I'll be happy. I got two little girls here, weddings, college. They're gonna.
My link will be right behind yours.
I'm pretty sure the word retirement doesn't exist in my future.
Right. I got puppy chow. I don't know if that's the same thing
Joseph, you don't get to talk anymore.
Yeah,
has our puppy giveaway worked yet? Have you been able to get any?
You know, people have reached out about these puppies. I'm very thankful for that. Of course, I can't, you know, they're here with me for 6 weeks. The
number's funny.
But look.
They said you're having 5 puppies.
Yeah, buy one, get 5 puppies. It's a special deal we got going on. I am confident that in 6 weeks or 5 weeks now, either me or the puppies will not be here. So that's here nor there.
Oh, my goodness.
So thank you so much for listening. Again, like, share, subscribe. We really appreciate you listening. If you ever have any ideas for the podcast, you can always email them to us or DM us on social media or email them to us at directexaminationpodcast@gmail.com. But thank you so much, guys. And we look forward to seeing you next week on the Direct Examination Podcast.
Thank you for listening.